This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we're going to be talking to two different people, very much with different approaches to the whole UFO phenomenon. Our first guest will be Eric Satra. Eric is an anthropologist. He takes no position on whether or not UFOs and aliens are real, but he is very interested in the cultures he studies. And he kind of stumbled upon a culture way out in the outback, in Aboriginal outback of Australia, a little community where they have a lot of close encounter stories and UFO sighting stories. And we will talk to him about this, both in the context of the stories themselves and also how they relate to the kind of cultural colonization that's present in so many parts of the world, in North America, in Australia, in Canada, in parts of Africa, and that is connected in some way to the UFO phenomenon. As you know, in A New World, I reported that the visitors told me that one of the main reasons they hang back is because they don't want to cause cultural colonization. They don't want to inflict that on us. We're a little less careful about inflicting it on each other. And the phenomenon, in some fascinating, subtle way, seems to me to reflect that in indigenous communities all around the world. So that's kind of what we're going to be discussing. Then we're going to take a U-turn. We are going to be talking to Mike, a contactee, a close encounter witness, not Mike Cleland. It's another Mike, but we call him Mike. That's not even his real name. And it can't be because the same cultures that deny this, he might lose his job or something, as you well know. So we'll be talking to him in the second half of the show. I think you're going to find it absolutely fascinating to talk first to an anthropologist who takes no position but studies people who has studied, I shouldn't say he's doing it now, but has studied people who have had a lot of UFO material in their culture, indigenous people. Then a direct close encounter witness who's going to take us deep into his direct personal experience. So sit tight and just enjoy this, because this is a special experience. You're not going to find this on any other podcast about this subject at all. Nobody else does it this way. I guess nobody else has the guts or the curiosity, or maybe they just haven't been doing it long enough, because I have, after all, been doing this since 1998, and I have thought an awful lot about it, including my own ongoing experiences. So we'll start out with Eric. But before we do that, free Dreamlanders, think of what you're missing, and you're going to miss a lot today, because you're not going to get the whole Mike story, and it is fantastic. We'll be right back.
When should you subscribe to unknowncountry.com? How about right now? Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
And do we ever need you right now? And do you ever need us? The new unknowncountry.com is beautiful. It is fully functional. The whole archive is working. It's full of amazing stuff. Plus, this is the only place like it in the world. Keep it going. It's up to you. Go to unknowncountry.com. You know what you have to do. It's only a few pennies a day. It's not a big sacrifice, but it means an awful lot.
Ever wonder what the close encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision. Not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
Today we're going way, way out into some very remote country. We're going into an Australian Aboriginal community in the Northwest Territories, in Northern Australia. You can't get more outback in the outback than this. We're talking to Eric Satra, a
associate professor at the University of Hawaii who has made a study of UFO experiences and UFO beliefs among Australian Aboriginals way, way out there in that very remote corner of Australia. Eric is an associate professor. He is an anthropologist, has been working in anthropology for many years, and I often troll a website or a system, I guess, called academia.edu, academia education, for papers that might be of interest to me and to our listeners. And I came across Close Encounters, UFO Beliefs in a Remote Australian Aboriginal Community by Eric from the Journal of the Royal Anthropological Institute. Eric, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, oddly enough, you're on Dreamland. We're going to be talking a lot about the Dreamtime, which sort of fits in a way. All right, let's set the scene. You decide at some point to do this. What went into that decision, and where were you when you decided to go off, way off into the outback? And we'll talk about where that is in a few minutes, but what made you decide to do this?
So I did this for my PhD research, and I wanted to really understand Aboriginal health and well-being and ideas about health and well-being, which includes things like using local herbs and plant remedies, also local healers, and how people interact with the local clinic that was there. And when I was doing the research, there was a 20-year life expectancy difference between Aboriginal people living in the Northern Territory and non-Aboriginal people living in the Northern Territory. And so I wanted to go and understand this. And I wanted to be based in a very remote community because of the issues in terms of transportation, access to resources, all of those things that kind of come along with that. And so I went out there to do this research, and on my very first time, before they even accepted me to go and live there, one of my very first conversations with someone, they told me about the aliens and the UFOs that were in this community. And so I spent 2.5 years living there, and I did my research on health and well-being, but the whole time I was there, everybody was talking about UFOs. And so it was really interesting. So I spent a lot of time kind of on the side doing research on this. And then once my PhD was finished, then I was able to publish on it.
So it's such a strange thing for them to be talking about on the side in a way. Is it something that you found to be common in other Aboriginal communities?
No. So the community I was at was the one known for UFOs. Everyone knew this. In fact, I was at a conference, an anthropology conference, and I met anthropologists who worked about, you know, relatively, quote, close for the outback, which was about 600 kilometers away. And I said, you've heard of us because you know about our UFOs. And she said, oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I know your community is the one that everybody talks about when it comes to UFOs. So it was considered like a UFO hotspot in the desert where more sightings happened. In other Aboriginal communities, there wasn't this discourse going on like there was where I was living.
So now, where exactly were you in? Tell us about the area.
Sure. So I worked in a part of Australia called the Tanami Desert, and it's between Darwin and Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, if you're looking at the map. This is an area, I worked with Walpree people, and they have now been settled, but prior to settlement by the Australian government, they were hunters and gatherers walking around the desert. And so now the Australian government has created settlements and people live there permanently now, although people do travel between them and out bush quite a lot. And I was 600 kilometers from, there was a small little shop small shop in the community, but to get to an actual big grocery store, I had to drive 600 kilometers. And at the time, if I wanted to go see a movie and go to a movie theater, I had to drive 900 kilometers. So I would go grocery shopping about once every 3 months and really stock up on stuff in town, and then come back and just try to get, you know, little things here and there from the local store. So it was pretty far out. But everybody was there was great and just adopted me and treated me wonderfully well.
So here you are. And by the way, do you know there's a military installation in that area called Pine Gap?
Yes.
Is that near this?
No, it's not.
Well, that's good, because there's quite a bit of activity around there, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And so this is about how far from it, Pine Gap, is it?
I'm not exactly sure. But it is a pretty pretty fair way. I never had any interactions with Americans or with military. So Pine Gap is about 900 kilometers away.
So it's really far. I mean,
that's
600, over 600 miles.
Yeah.
So this is not connected with military activity, is what I'm getting at, because a lot of people, I think, as I recall, there are experimental aircraft and various types of things going on there that people might mistake for UFOs, but not 900 miles away, I wouldn't think.
No, and the UFO sightings were very seasonal as well, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later. They mostly occurred during the wet season. That was the season for UFOs. So it wasn't something that it technically could happen year-round.
Technically could happen year-round, but actually happened only infrequently except during the wet season. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about it now rather than later. I think that, of course, the taking on of water is something that goes way back into the fairy faith, as in Northern Europe at least, as Jacques Vallée points out in his book Passport to Magonia. There are stories of these strange craft or entities taking on water that go back literally many, many, many years. And now here we are with a situation like this. Can you tell us a little bit more about the region? And it has obviously a dry season and a wet season. And tell us how that works and when the wet season takes place.
The wet season takes place over the southern summer, and particularly in the northern regions of the Northern Territory, roads can be cut off. In the very southern part of the Northern Territory, it's still a lot drier. There's a creek in Alice Springs that was the Todd River, which is often dry. In fact, when they have the Henley on Todd Regatta, they actually are required to have a dry creek bed because people make their little boat costumes and run through it. And if there's ever water in the creek, they actually have to cancel the regatta. So the wet season is actually quite dramatic when it happens. All these dry rivers can start to flow. It's really beautiful. So for Aboriginal people, the wet season is an important time. It was back when people were hunting and gathering, when people would come together more to do ceremony, because there was more water and more game. And then people would disperse at other parts of the year into smaller groups. And the water is also important in terms of stories that people have over guardians of the land. So I think a lot of people probably have heard of rainbow serpents. In Walpri, they're called Wanayara. And these are large snake-like beings that inhabit water, basically. So water holes, they can be in the rain clouds. There's a very big salt lake in Central Australia that is dry, but Wanayara live under its surface. And so these rainbow serpents are also guardians of the land. And so when I would go out to my adopted, so I was adopted into a family, as many people are. And when I would go to my family's land, they would always introduce me to the Waneata, so they would not hurt me. So they would see, you know, who is this white guy coming out here? And so the elder men would speak to the Waneata and say, look, this is an adopted member of the family, and please don't hurt him, and please protect him while he's here. And so Waneata make sure that the people on the land are those who own the land, who belong to the land, and they're associated with water. And so what I'm arguing in this paper is the same kind of thing is happening with people's narratives about UFOs. So while Walpri people talk about seeing UFOs, they themselves do not report abductions. But what they say is that the UFOs do abduct white people, or Cardia in Walpri.
I read that.
That's right. And so the UFOs realize that Aboriginal people belong on the land and white people don't. And so I was always told early on, if you don't want to get abducted, hang out with Aboriginal people. That will keep you safe. But if you're a white person driving by yourself, particularly at night during the wet season, you kind of need to worry a little bit.
You know, so, among certain Native American tribes in the U.S., I've heard that they are not concerned about being abducted, but that the white people around them may be. It's interesting. Yes. I'm not an anthropologist, and I can't give you chapter and verse, but I think that's not uncommon, not an uncommon attitude in this country either.
And so people were very conscious of this and of having these and telling these stories to white people. So in the community that I lived in, as in many Aboriginal communities, there was a lot of segregation that was happening. So one part of the town was basically where white workers lived. And there were very few, but the school teachers, the administrators, several of the tradesmen, the mechanics were white. And they came in and they did their work and then would leave. They never saw the community as home. They would maybe live there for a year or two and then they would go. Whereas the Walpri residents, that was their home. They often lived in overcrowded houses. There weren't always enough homes for Walpri people, but each non-Aboriginal family got their own home. So if you were a single man working at the service station, for instance, you had your own home, whereas a Walpri person usually had a lot of people living with them. And so there were these real differences. It was a dry community. You weren't allowed to have alcohol. If you had alcohol within 10 miles of the community, your car would be confiscated. But white people drank, and the police were white. So the police didn't arrest the white people for drinking. They could get a permit, but often the white people didn't get a permit to drink because they just knew the white police weren't going to arrest them. So there were these kind of double standards and this segregation that pervaded everything. And Aboriginal people were really concerned about this being their community and the impact of these white workers on it. And they were also, very conscious of the inequality that was happening there. And so statements about UFOs, one of the things I write about is these statements of UFOs were one way to kind of give voice to this inequality. And whereas white people would say, oh, Waneata, that's Aboriginal superstition. When Aboriginal people talked about UFOs, white people listened. And there was one school teacher in particular who got very nervous driving by himself in the wet season. And so it was a way of kind of incorporating white people into a narrative about land and belonging, and one in which white people didn't belong there. And it was a way for Aboriginal people to really kind of talk about this and have a dialogue about difference and segregation in remote Australia.
Any experiences or any sightings, rather, did you?
I didn't. No, I was never with anybody when they said, oh, look, that's it. And I should also say that UFO sightings were one kind of sighting. There were also something called the Min Min Lights, which I also did not see. Several people I know saw them, and they're like kind of big balls of whitish light that zip around the roads at night.
Yes.
And I have not seen those either, and they're considered distinct from UFO sightings. So there are different kind of light phenomenon that you can see in this part of the desert. I have not seen any of them.
Yeah, you know, I used to see out in West Texas something called the Marfa lights. It was a long drive out there, and when I was a college student, a teenager, it was fun to convince girls to go out and look for the Marfa lights because, well, anyway, I was a boy, and when I could get a girl to go on a date like that with me, I was happy. And I saw them once or twice. Mm-hmm. Later, William Mallow, he wasn't a geologist, but he was a materials science expert and knew an awful lot about energy and the way it is generated by different types of materials being together and so forth. He said he thought that it was a piezoelectric effect. In other words, it was caused by the rocks cooling after the day, because it's where they're seen. It's a very rocky area, and it's granite and basalt, and so they would expand with the heat of the sun during the day, and then during the night, as they contracted, these piezoelectric energies would come out of them. But when you saw them, they were really incredibly eerie. They really looked like. Mm-hmm. They looked like they were looking at you. Let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. It was really fun when you were a kid. I only saw them a couple times, but it was a lot of fun. So these are different, and they're probably a natural phenomenon. And I'm not going to ask you. We talked off the air, and it's not Eric's work to speculate about what these things are. In other words, that's my area. But I am going to return now to this business of the white people being the ones that are susceptible to abduction, because what you said was absolutely fascinating to me, in that the local aboriginals think that the white people are susceptible to abduction because they don't really belong on that land.
Yes.
Well, interestingly enough, in the parts of the Native American community I am familiar with, they don't expect to get abducted, but they do say that white people can disappear because of this. What did the aboriginals say the same, don't they? They'll disappear. They won't come back.
That's right. And there was a story. There was a health worker that had come to do some work there, and he left, and everybody I talked to said he didn't turn back up in town, and they didn't know where he was, and they assumed that the alien had taken him, and that was the story going around the community for quite a while. So there is a discourse certainly about the abduction of white people, and people feel there's considerable evidence that supports it.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating and a little disturbing too, because not coming back to me is bad news. I mean, people think I would love to go with the aliens. It depends on what's going to happen when you do. And, you know, frankly, in this country, we have a lot of disappearances that are unexplained, especially especially in sort of backcountry areas. And I wonder if you ever were aware of anything other than that one case, or was this something that the white people talked about, for example?
I was not, and I did not get this confirmed outside of the Aboriginal people that I was talking to. The white people were certainly, as I said, the school teacher were certainly concerned about it. And there were a number in the community that actually did alter their behavior during the wet season. And I should also mention some of the context of all this is that I was doing field work in the 1990s. And so at the time, X-Files was on television and very popular. And one old Aboriginal man came up to me and he said, there's no Aboriginal, there's no real shows about Aboriginal people. There were a few, but not very popular. He said, but The X-Files, he said, that is an Aboriginal show. He said, because that talks about what our experiences are like. And it's not exactly what's happening here, but it's at least an acknowledgement in a way that we don't get an acknowledgement through media in other ways. And so this was really something, this was a very big dialogue. As I said, my very first time out in the desert with Aboriginal, the first time I was coming into the community, we camped halfway out in the desert, and a guy opened up the back of his Toyota, and boomerangs fell out, and it's the first time I had seen real boomerangs, and I was talking to him about that, and he pulled out the boomerangs, and then we sit down, and he starts talking about UFOs. So
why would he start really talking about UFOs?
Because we were out in the country at
night. Simply because you were out in the country.
Yeah, and so we were out. He was talking to his friends. He was saying, "Well, maybe there will be a sighting tonight." And so it was, these stories when I was there, at least, were very much part and parcel of the community, and it wove together like popular culture stuff on television, Aboriginal beliefs, ideas about inequality and race. And belonging and the land and all of that in this one thing.
We're going to take a little break, so enjoy these commercials. We'll be right back. You know, Free Dreamlanders, the reason I talk so much about subscribing to this website is that we are trying to go it without advertising, so you do not get tracking cookies or anything like that on unknowncountry.com. And so far, we are just making it, barely. I contribute a little bit of money every month to the site, and the subscribers step up, and we keep going. Now, I'd like to tell you some reasons about why you should think about doing this. Not only is it an important website, but give you an idea of some of the shows that you can go into the search engine, and you can find all kinds of stuff. Like if you search on Dreamland, and then UFO, you will find things like Nazi UFO secrets from 2006, the incredible story of the Iranian UFO, Air Force UFO shoot down that was carried out by General Parvez Jafari, and he's on Dreamland actually discussing the mission. And you just can't get that anywhere else. There is not anywhere you can do this. It's an amazing website, absolutely amazing. So go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab and join us. It starts at $5 a month. It's not by any means the most expensive one you will find on the internet. So put this on pause, do it right now, and then come back to this show. We're talking to anthropologist Eric Satra about his adventures in the Australian outback in a community that, it turned out, had a lot of UFO sightings. And not only that, one member of the white population in the community had disappeared. And so we're exploring this. Eric is an anthropologist. We're not exploring whether or not UFOs are real or aliens or anything like that. He is simply reporting on what he found and what he not what he believes personally. I have no idea what Eric believes about UFOs, and I'm not going to ask him because this is not what we're doing. Let's talk a little bit more about Bill. This is a man who had disappeared, and did they try to find him or anything? Are the police notified?
I believe so. So he didn't live in the community. So what happened there, because these places are so remote? For a lot of services, they will bring someone from town, will drive the 600 kilometers out to the community. So the dentist, for instance, would drive out 600 kilometers, be there for a day or two, maybe once every 6 months, and then turn around and drive back. So mental health services, child welfare, all of these things were provided remotely from town. And so we had this constant kind of influx of people coming in for a few days and then disappearing to go back into town. And so he was one of these people. And he was being monitored by the local council. You know, they keep track of who's coming and going because you need a permit if you're non-Aboriginal to go into these communities. You can't just rock up. And so he left. He had come down for 2 days. He left and went back. And the people who had kind of facilitated his visit and his work in the community said that he never got in touch with him when he returned to Catherine. And so they told me that they contacted the office he was with, and they didn't know where he was, and that they were contacting the police and trying to find him. And then, again, I was told that he didn't turn up. But, as I said, I myself did not talk to the police or talk to the office that he worked for. I only talked to the people in the community, and the consensus was that he had gone.
So it could be anything. I mean, he could just have been, gone on to another job.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
But, I think it's also a powerful metaphor of how white people turn up in these communities temporarily and then do just disappear.
Right.
And so they're not grounded in place. And so in that sense, also, they don't belong.
Right. And in fact, these people will say that they're not endangered because the aliens know them and know that this is their land.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
that's right. And so for them, for Wall Creek people, UFO sightings were never particularly scary. It was not something that they dreaded or something that they necessarily tried to avoid. And none of them ever had contact. Nobody saw inside a ship. No one saw figures. It was only the ships in the sky or the ships over water holes that they saw. So there were no descriptions of what an alien would look like or did look like. Those did not occur at all.
Yeah, because they never were face to face with them, but they did
see them. That's right.
They did see them drawing water up into their craft from time
to
time.
That's
Can
right.
you describe
right.
what they said that was like?
So again, they said that the UFOs were always drawn to water sources, and so there are in the desert these rock holes, particularly in a few regions, and so they would talk about how they saw these light ships hovering over these water holes, extracting the water, and then immediately flying off. And all of these encounters were brief. They did describe saucer-shaped ships, but then they also described ships that were just like glowing light as well. And so the descriptions did change from sighting to sighting. They were not always consistent.
In the Hudson Valley in the United States in the 80s, mid-80s, they were people who witnessed similar things of these objects hanging over water and lifting the water somehow up into themselves in columns. And it, as I mentioned earlier in Jacques Vallée's book, Passport to Magonia, water plays a very large role in all of this. And this goes back long before the UFO narrative started, back into the well into the 19th century or probably earlier. I haven't read Jacques' book carefully recently, and so I don't know how early the first case of this is. In any case, it's possible to look at it from a different point of view, from an more anthropological point of view, and to assume that there's some kind of cultural rationale behind it. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe it has something to do with the lack of water in the area. But upstate New York and Ireland and places like that are well watered. So no. What do you think it might have to do with culturally? I mean, why would it be that people would say they would see a thing like this? Say, if we're not assuming, let's erase the idea that it is really an alien spacecraft taking on water, and explore how it might, how the culture might generate an idea like this that's spread across the world. Or can we? Do we have to just leave that an open question?
I mean, I can talk about it in the context of Australia, but as an anthropologist, I'm really uncomfortable making larger claims. I'm really good talking about specifics of what I saw and what I did, but something like extrapolating from what's happening here to then linking it up with someplace else.
Okay, good enough. Then I withdraw the question, and let's continue with your area of expertise. And I think maybe the best thing to do is to just go off of that, because unless there's more that you would like to say about this whole business of water and seasonality and so forth, it fascinates me, and I think it's a very hard area to get into. To how a culture is reacting and how the land is related to it and stuff. I don't know quite how to ask questions about that.
Well, I think here the water, I think, is particularly significant because of Wanayara and because of their association with the water. And I think the UFOs, the way that people talk about them, those narratives really resemble, certainly don't exactly replicate, but certainly resemble narratives about rainbow serpents. And so water is very significant for people, and the power of beings associated with water to determine who belongs and who doesn't is also very significant. And I think, as I said before, that, you know, when you tell a non-Aboriginal person, oh, there are these rainbow serpents, they generally kind of blow that off as something that is, you know, either superstitious or not true. But the second you say UFO, people listen, and not original people listen. And so it's a way to talk about people's beliefs and ideas and ways of being in the world in a way that I think gives them a wider audience. I mean, just the fact that I'm getting interviewed on this podcast is wonderful. You know, there aren't really, you know, the rainbow serpents, that's a harder thing to talk about. And so this is, I think one of the things that people get from having these narratives about UFOs is that they are able to share their ideas about the world with others and have others listen to them and engage with them. And then also engage with the history and difference and kind of settlement of Central Australia and the current social issues and struggles that people are facing in Aboriginal communities today.
Exactly. And it's relevant in that sense. And I want to bring in now the presence of television and TV shows, mm-hmm. and things like that. They were readily available, I presume.
Yes, yes. Exactly. And as I said, X-Files was very popular.
How do you think Western media influenced the people you were working with in terms of their UFO beliefs and sightings and so forth?
I do think it influenced them because these things were very pervasive. Independence Day was also happening around that time. And people, we got three television stations at the and so it was something that you could watch on TV. And Wall Creek people are very media savvy. There was a video conferencing set up there. This was before Skype. And Wall Creek people produced their own media. And so there was this real sense of wanting to see what was out there and internalizing it and thinking about it and then producing a response to it. And people like Faye Ginsburg have written a lot about Wall Creek media and the production of Indigenous media and the way in which media has impacted people's lives and ideas.
So it obviously played an enormous role. There's no way to tell whether or not they had these stories before the appearance of Western media, is there?
There isn't, but there are. One of the things that we haven't talked about, and I don't really think I wrote about it, is sky dreaming.
Yeah, you mentioned the word once or twice in the paper.
Yes. So, you know, we started off talking about the dreaming just a little bit, and there is a sky dreaming for stars and there are stories of people going up to the stars and beings in the stars. The people that I spoke with never connected UFOs explicitly to those stories, but I'm told that in other communities, sometimes there is that connection. So again, this is a you know, each place is kind of different. And so I can only talk about what I saw and what people told me. But it does seem that there are a number of kind of connections and different ways of seeing things. So that, yes, media can play a role, but you have things not just like Wanayera, but also like sky dreaming and beliefs and attitudes about stars and things that are happening in the heavens that, you know, can also be seen as being independent in some ways of these media representations.
Now, you say that here that tales of the aliens and the abductions mirror to some extent the reaction to colonialism, because these are colonized people. They're profoundly colonized.
That's right. Profoundly colonized, yes.
Right. And it's a colonialism that is so deep that there probably the rest of the expression of mankind on Earth is going to be somehow they'll never be beyond it unless Australia ceases to exist as an organized community and they survive. There's a connection here in that aliens are obviously depicted as invaders in many, many, many science fiction contexts, and goodness knows, in the Close Encounter experience, they are called intruders and so on and so forth. And these people are actually experiencing that. This is their life. They live in a life that's been intruded. So
that's right.
So talk about that, the way that connects to their alien beliefs, for example.
So I think it's a nice kind of, in some ways, inversion of what is happening. So Aboriginal people are profoundly colonized and have been, are very aware of that. But if aliens now are going to colonize Earth, and aliens recognize that Aboriginal people belong on the land and aren't abducting them and are letting them do their thing, then they have nothing to fear from this second wave of colonization. It, in fact, is the colonizers, the non-Aboriginal colonizers, that need to fear colonization, not this new colonization that can come from an alien invasion, in a way that the colonized, the currently colonized indigenous people of Australia do not. And so if aliens are dangerous to the non-Aboriginal population, they are, in fact, to some extent, almost beneficial to the Aboriginal population, because they do leave them on land, whereas they're getting rid of the white colonizers.
Right.
And so it's a complete reframing of these kind of media narratives in a way that is just inverts these things.
You know, it's similar in the Native American communities that I'm familiar with, because I noticed a long time ago that two things. First is that the Native American peoples who have been exposed basically to white American ideas about aliens don't have the same attitude toward them at all. And second, I've been in more than one situation on a reservation where I have had close encounter experiences, and people were rather indifferent to them. In other words, they mm-hmm. weren't concerned at all. They didn't feel like anything was going to happen to them. And it was never brought into never articulated, but I think that the Aboriginals have articulated it very well. As you say, they say that they belong to the land, and yeah. the aliens know it. So whatever this is, it accepts their presence in the land. Is there any place, I wonder at all, that the white person belongs? I know this is not. I'm departing a little bit from your area of expertise, but my listeners know that one of the things I think about a lot is something that was said to a close encounter witness in an abduction experience to Betty Andreas, and it was said in Gaelic, and she didn't speak Gaelic, but the line was, when I had it translated, children of the northern peoples, you wander in eternal darkness, and you have to wonder, where are we? And what is the Aboriginals' attitude toward us, toward the colonizers? Because they live on us now. You say that it's somewhere in the paper, you say it's a 67% unemployment rate. In other words, they're all on the dole. They depend on the colonizers.
That's right. And that, that was set up by the Australian government to some extent. So for a very long time in the Northern Territory, really up until kind of the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s, Aboriginal people were, for the most part, not allowed to have cash. And they were expected to work for rations. So for things like tinned meat, sugar, and flour, which in part is why there are very high health disparities. And so, one community wasn't even set up on traditional Walpri land. Rather, the community was set up there because it was next to a cattle station. The government took people and said, no, you're going to stay here so you can work for this cattle station. And what you will be paid in is food that is not particularly healthy. And they also set up these ration stations where they would have – expect Aboriginal people to all eat together. It would be feed them in groups, and they had to eat with knives and forks. And this was a method of assimilation. So there's a wonderful book, White Flour, White Power, by Tim Rouse, about how the Australian government tried to use food and feeding to assimilate Aboriginal people and make them more like white people. And so, and Aboriginal people are well aware that this happened and know that this is in fact ongoing. If you look at the intervention that happened in the Northern Territory and the way in which the dole was restructured to kind of limit Aboriginal people's access to it. They actually had to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act to do this. Aboriginal people know this is happening. So there are all the time these conversations about this inequality and about being colonized. And the UFOs are one way to reframe this.
And yeah, because of the fact that there's an empowerment implied.
Yes.
That the aliens have a different attitude toward the Aboriginals. And this is reflected in many, many different native cultures around the world. You went to the Star Knowledge Conference you mentioned the Star Knowledge Conference.
I mentioned it. Yeah, I did not go.
Yeah, you weren't there. I was there, oddly enough. And in any case, it was a remarkable conference because it was Sioux, Hopi, Iroquois, Choctaw, Oneida. Mm-hmm. All kind of Mayan people were there, Maori. And they all talked about their knowledge of extraterrestrials to, you put it, non-indigenous UFO enthusiasts, that is to say, people like me. And it was really a remarkable experience. That's why during the course of our conversation, that's been kind of my awareness of what was said there is kind of been threaded in. Now, this is a way, I think, of using a kind of a Western meme in order to regain their own cultural identity in the context of a mystery that is part of Western culture also, but that the Westerners yes. can't assimilate. Would that be a fair thought?
I think it is.
So we have it's a fascinating situation. I have to thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that we haven't talked about yet that you think is important and that you would like to bring up?
Well, I think just something to mention briefly is technology. And so the aliens have more technology than non-Aboriginal people do. And so oftentimes technology is again, one of those things that is used in popular discourse to kind of separate Indigenous and non-Indigenous people or colonized and colonizer. And here you have a society in the aliens that is certainly more technologically advanced, that is able to travel the stars, that is able to do all of this in a way that non-Aboriginal people cannot, that the way that white people cannot. And so then if a non-Aboriginal person tries to look down on an Aboriginal person and say, oh, well, you were a former hunter and gatherer, or you know, boomerangs and spears are no match for a gun, this is a way to say, yes, we might not have all this technology, but in fact, the UFOs do, and they have more technology than you do. So you really shouldn't think of yourselves as being particularly superior to us when the UFOs, with all the technology that they have and their knowledge and ability to travel the stars, recognize us for who we are and our link to the land. I just think that's another important aspect of this.
An attempt to both preserve and protect their identity and to re-empower themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, all of it. And I would like to thank you for having been with us on Dreamland. And, I'm sure that my listeners are going to be fascinated by this because nobody talks about it. Nobody, absolutely nobody talks about it. We've had one other researcher on this show talking about Aboriginals, and I know there are quite a few researchers in Australia who only research this among the whites. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, and frankly, I wish more people would look at Indigenous UFO beliefs. I just think it's wonderfully interesting, and in the article I mentioned, South Africa, Credo Mutwa, talks about aliens as being a type of witch familiar, which is really interesting. And you've talked about all of the Native American connection. It just seems like around the world, there's a lot happening with this. And you're right, there's almost no research being done on it. And I really wish there would be. So if there are any listeners out there looking for a research project, I think this is a great one.
Yeah, I do too. We've been talking to Eric Satra, Close Encounters, UFO Beliefs in a Remote Australian Aboriginal Community. He actually went out, way out into the outback, and ended up discussing UFO beliefs because it turned out that the people out there had a whole cultural interchange with this phenomenon, just as is true over the world. And as Eric so correctly pointed out, there's very little research into what the Native peoples and the Indigenous peoples around the world think about this. But there should be more, as Eric points out. So if you have the right credentials and you're interested, why don't you write whitley@streber.com and I'll get you in touch with Eric. And you can take it from there. Maybe you could get a grant for this. It's not impossible, although in the age of COVID, God knows what will happen if you try. But in any case, Eric, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an absolute pleasure.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, you'll hear more.
Where do you find Eben Alexander, Dean Radin, Jim Mars, Joseph Farrell, Zechariah Sitchin, William Henry, George Noory, Lawrence Gardner, Trish and Rob McGregor, Richard Dolan, Starfire Tour, Linda Moulton Howe, and hundreds of others all telling you their deepest secrets? In the Dreamland Archive on UnknownCountry.com. All yours for under $5 a month. Go to UnknownCountry.com and subscribe today. hours of listening pleasure. Expect to be amazed.
Next up, contactee Mike.
They are found deep in a dying jungle, 6 infants. They aren't apes. They aren't human either, not quite. So, what are they? When they are spirited off to the United States, an incredible discovery is made. They are as smart as us, but not us, not human. The company that found them wants to buy and sell them as the most valuable animals on Earth, brilliant workers who need not be paid. Somebody has to stop this travesty, and that's where primatologist Beth Cook comes in. But can she stand up to the power and wealth that seeks to exploit them? Find out in Whitley Strieber's first standalone science fiction novel in 7 years. New. Get it on Amazon as an ebook or paperback.
Next up, we're going to be talking to contactee Mike. The entire interview will also be recorded in the contactee section. Now, this Mike is not Mike Clellan, who podcasts on unknowncountry.com. It's another entirely different Mike, just so we're clear on that. Mike, I'd like to begin to ask you, what made you decide to talk about this?
The fact that I feel that people need to wake up to the fact we are being visited.
Yeah, well, I wonder why they can't do that. You know, the New York Times has got all these stories about it, and there's other places where they're screaming, I believe on Wired or somewhere like that. You know, why does the New York Times keep writing about this stupid stuff? It's not real. What is their problem? I just don't get it. And as far as we're concerned, we're like anathema. I mean, you don't want to be a close encounter witness. That's why I can't even say your last name. I mean, what would happen to you and your business, whatever it is, and don't tell us, if they knew?
They would honestly think I was nuts.
Well, exactly.
This is not something that you get money from. This is not something that your family will like to hear, friends, or anybody for that matter. I mean, everybody lives their life in this tight little box, but the thing is, they don't realize there is no box.
Right. Well, you know, I'm in the same boat. I can't have my grandchildren, their friends must not know who I am. Absolutely not. I never would attend a social function at my children's house. Never. I'm very, very concealed. And I think it's unfortunate that that's the case, because it means that we're not getting to know what's really happening, and maybe it's quite possibly the single most important thing that is happening in our world, and it's completely buried. It's under the surface. But let's go back now and talk about what happened to you. What was the first thing that happened that kind of was an off note in your life, maybe would be the best way to put it, something that you thought, what's going on here?
Well, interestingly enough, my whole life has been off note, but something that really kickstarted it was after I got back from my honeymoon with my wife. I woke up about a week after to our bedroom being lit up with blue light. Felt very calm, no problems, no nothing, and I felt a hand turn my head to the left. It was as if I was being touched by like a static electrical charge, but it was physical. And I saw a blue-gray image in front of my face. And I started putting two and two together after that.
And when you say put two and two together, what do you mean? What did you...
Well, my whole life has been filled with strange occurrences that I always thought was haunting. I've always known I've been a hypersensitive, so has my family. We talked about it here and there, but most of the time they would tell me, don't say anything because they're just going to lock you up. So I didn't, but my whole family, has experienced this kind of stuff. And, a lot of the things that I chalked up to as, paranormal experiences seem to be leading up to that point of where it's not just ethereal or ghostly, it is otherworldly.
What do you mean by that word? What does the otherworldly mean to you?
Well, otherworldly means not necessarily extraterrestrial. It could be anything from inner space, outer space, to interdimensional. That's what that means to me.
Can you tell us about any specific kind of contact incident that you recall from the early days?
Yes, I can.
Beyond the blue light, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a child, I used to have like visits at night, and I thought they were friends of the family. The reason why is because I never actually looked at them as extraterrestrial or anything like that. I had this one being I called Gerard that would actually watch me as they played at night. Now, the situation is I had insomnia my whole life. I've had a hard time getting to sleep, all that. And every once in a while, I thought my parents would have like friends over. And they would bring their kids, or so I thought they were kids. And they looked a bit like me wearing blue pajamas. I thought it was just like a sleepover or something like that. Usually it's two or three of them and Gerard. And, well, one of the things that was offsetting to me, because I remember this a little later in life, this was the offset that Gerard, one time I was playing with my Lincoln Logs. And you know how those Lincoln Logs are not bound together. They're just held together through gravity.
Right.
Right. Well, Gerard, it was like a little boathouse kind of thing that I was making. I don't know. Specifically, this is really deep in my memory and stuck there. Gerard reached down and picked up this like log cabin looking house and turned it all around and looked at it and nodded at it and put it back down. But the thing is how could he have done that without it falling apart? I mean, it's one of those things I've learned is kids learn about gravity pretty quick in life. You know, what goes up must come down. But this did not come down the way it should have come down because he spun it around. Things like that. That's pretty much one of the biggest memories I've had of that.
And free Dreamlanders, there's a lot more, obviously. Oh, well, I have to say goodbye to you. I don't like doing it every week, and I hope every week there'll be fewer of you who just tune us out at the end of an hour. But anyway, you listened this long, so thank you so much for staying with us and being with us. Lots more to come.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.